there is problematic. What is normally? Who determines the norm? Is there a halakhic norm? I will talk about it, okay? That's the problem. But let's deal with the situation, okay? We assume there's a certain norm, and now that norm is being violated with exposed, then that's being exposed. And because it's normally covered, and now it's exposed, it creates a sexual distraction. Okay? Now we're all going to have to ask a question. If we say this is a problem only for men or is it a problem for women too? Can a woman daven in the presence of another woman who's now who has a tefach show? What's the two sides? That's right. If the reason is ultimately sexual distraction, she's not sexually distracted. Because it's another woman. However, unless you're dealing with this problem. Excuse me, and in such a case, we'll have to talk about that. That is sexual distraction, sexual distraction. And you'll think of the Aruch HaShulchan as sexual distraction.
What about
a fool? In front of a man who's sexually distracted. I said, normally we assume, okay, let me just throw it out now, but we'll come back to it later. The halachic normative assumption is that men, which was, of course, confirmed by Kinsey. No, but it's true. The Kinsey did a great many studies on men and women, and one of the studies was that men tend to fantasize and become sexually aroused by fantasy alone, and women tend to need contact, foreplay, become sexually aroused. Doesn't mean that women never get sexually aroused, and that's what the Aruch HaShulchan is going to deal with. Which is a normative situation. If I'm a codifier and I have to make halacha, the question is, what is the normative situation that I have to assume? So the halacha assumes that men can become sexually stimulated by thought alone, by just seeing, while women need more physical contact. And that was the report, of course, that Kinsey came out in the 50s. Feminists have argued that in the modern period it's not true, but I think there was a recent study that we confronted that. So, and that's why...
There's a study that debunked Kinsey.
I think they claim themselves socially. My vast experience has confirmed these results. Now, I was only joking. She didn't make sure they take says that. I was only joking. Now continue, okay? We're not finished. Let's go through the basic material. Next week we'll come back, we'll again, we're gonna analyze it as we're getting through the thing. Now, Ela b'ishto ule k'lishman. Ishto and le k'lishman. Now, what suppose it's not this one?
Right.
I'm
politically incorrect.
Well, it's not this one. Maybe what Halacha said that what? That tefach, that you can see, that what does the tefach mean? Means, what about less than a tefach? Then it's okay. Then it doesn't count. Well, is it okay? Is it okay? Or is it? Let's put it this way. It does not contravene my fulfillment of the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. I can go ahead and say Kriyat Shema, but it's something else as well.
What are you doing
with that
anyway?
I mean, yes, somebody else is home, and she's walking around. You can see that there might be postman who would say that if somebody else is even less than that. Anything. Mushroom.
Okay. What if it's a daughter?
What?
A daughter or
a sister.
I would, the daughter is probably a daughter or a sister in some position. Okay. Ishto is considered, daughter, close relative. They're talking about intimate relatives, like daughter, sister. Sister also, mother, grandmother, granddaughter probably. The postkin tend to maintain that these are in the same category as mother. Okay, because they're all questions about hugging and kissing and all that stuff, which are not considered a problem. So sexual, these are less of a sexual problem. Well, the point of why your wife is that you're not going to be sexually aroused because it essentially is permitted. She's permissible to you. And therefore, it's not that's the problem of mind removing in top of it.
It's a very interesting idea, but. Then why can't you see a fence shake between the time of the month?
Excuse me?
Is this the fence shake between the time of the month?
No, because the Gemara says, the only time that makes a difference is a chatan and a kala. If she's a nida, we don't want to sleep with her, we don't want to even sleep in the same room together. They have to be, if she's really a nida, the time of the chuppah, halacha dictates they can't sleep alone together. Because he's never been with her. Okay? But if after that point, you assume that since he knows it's through permissible, it's okay. You know, who buys time is not about. Yes?
If it's not his wife, then he would never see it.
Why not? I told you, I'll give that. She walked around, she wanted an example, just for argument's sake. Okay, let's assume that here she normally is this, and she's walking around, she's cleaning up the house, and she's walking around with short sleeves. She rolled up her sleeves to do the windows.
Is there a time limit? I mean, can't you just look away?
What? She asked me, can I turn around, can I look away, can I do? Okay, the best is...
You stare at her and say she can't throw the same.
No question, but you are a rabbi performing a wedding. The kala is wearing a low-cut dress. You have to make the sheva brachot, right? You have to make the berakat erusin. What do you do? And you make the bracha. You turn it back to the kala and make the bracha. What do you do? Can you close your eyes? Can you look sideways? Can you hold the super in front of your face? I mean, what can you do? Is that a problem? Okay?
You started it.
By the way, these stories are true. Amar Rav Chizda, shok v'isha erva. We're having a problem. Let's translate shok for as a starting position as a thigh. Okay, the thigh of a woman's thigh beginning above the knee. Okay, although everybody knows that. What is this called? What is it called in Hebrew? Yerev. What's this called? Shok. Very good. Okay, but we'll have to talk about this. Trust me. Okay, so this is normally translated as shok, and this is yarek. Ikao shok al yarek means the bottom part of the shok, and then, okay? The question is whether, in the halakha, is there a possibility that shok also refers to the higher part? And we'll talk about that, okay? Anywho, this relates to the whole question why girls in Ne'asharim wear black stockings down to the right bottom, because they hold this is shok and not this is shok. But Mishabura held that this is shok. Well, anyway, we'll talk about this. Patience. Let's argue shok, meaning the higher part, okay? From the knee above. So, the Gemara says, shok v'isha erva, how do I know that a shok is erva? Shenemar gali shok ivri na'or Yishayahu, when he's talking about the improper action, the promiscuous action of the daughter of Israel with other gods, and talks in a very sexual term, she says, gali shok ivri na'or, uncover your shok and cross the river. Uchtiv tigal elvatech v'gam tira'echem patech, uncover your nakedness and that your shame be seen. So you see that based on the tikbolet, comparison of the two, you see that shok refers to erva, because the two parts of the pasuk. Okay? So that's shok. So what's the problem with that statement? Was there any problem with that statement? Shok b'isha erva? What do I need it for? I just said what? Teva b'isha erva. So choke is tell choke b'sheva, but I need choke b'sheva, just a tefa b'sheva.
No, maybe you need to apply the tefa.
Ah, so you might argue, yes, by shah, by tef, by tot, by normally it's only tefa, but choke is different. Why is choke different? No,
shoke.
Ah, very clever, very, yes, very clever. That's the Bach. The Bach argues that you might think that the strict women getting on the floor and washing the floor, whatever it is, in the course of her work, her shoke might be partially come to be uncovered, right? She might think that it might be more lenient, so it comes up to tell you to be more strict. No, shoke be sherva, just even though sometimes it's uncovered. Or maybe because by men, it's uncovered, tends to be uncovered. Or the other possibility is though shoke is more chamur. Okay, these are different possibilities which are exactly opposite of each other. Don't get confused. These are different views in this Gemara leading to different halakhic conclusions. Shoke is more chamur by tefach, by normally an uncovered place. She uncovers it by her arm, how much contravenes davening. Tefach. Okay? But shoke, since shoke is closer to the genital areas, that's more sexually distracting than even anything. Shoke isn't anything of the shoke. As the other things are teva, this shoke is different. Shoke is an exception. Each one leads to different conclusions. Okay. Amar Shmuel. Okay. Amar Shmuel. Kol b'isha elva. The voice of a woman is contravenes the saying of Kriyat Shema. Shenema ki kolech arev umarech nave. Okay. Questions. What call are we talking about?
Yeah.
Speaking voice, singing
talking
voice.
Talking about singing or
voice,
speaking.
Singing or speaking, right? Does that make a difference? Married, unmarried, does that make any difference? Jew, non-Jew.
Individual group.
Individual group, all sorts of good questions, right. Amar Rav Sheshet, Seyar b'isha erva. The exposed hair of a woman is erva. Shenemar, Se'arech ke'edeh ha'izim. Your hair is like the hair of a flock of sheep. Okay.
What is wrong with a woman's
what?
What is it wrong?
It's considered sexually distracting.
Attractive.
Sexually attractive. No, not attractive.
Sexually distracting.
Yeah, go ahead. You want to ask a question? I'm sorry.
But they start out with the premise that tefach b'isha erva, and then the next people that speak, are they adding to that, or
They're adding to it.
They're saying not just tefach, but also
right. Not just tefach, but also shok, or whatever shok is.
No.
They all agree. Sure. Now the question is, okay, call we are. Yes, go ahead.
About the seyar b'isha erva, if we're talking about tefach being something that's normally covered,
so
then doesn't that already cover the
sayah? That's right. Doesn't it normally cover the sayah? That's assumed. Now we haven't talked about a married woman's obligation to cover her hair. We'll talk about that. Not today, but we will start at the beginning. That's one of the sources we have to talk about briefly. We're going to go through it very briefly, and then again we'll do it a second time. We'll go through it the iyun, a great deal of the iyun. But yes, there's a separate obligation for a married woman to cover her hair.
Why? He says
that.
That's a very good question, I would say, because the Torah told us so. Okay, essentially it's a sign that was considered a traditional biblical sign for one's being married. Good question also. This is clearly right. This is nothing. This is rabbinical prohibitions based on sexual distraction. And therefore the Chazal said, how do we know that sexually distracting? So they bring a pasuk. This is an example, it's called Nasmachta. Nasmachta is some mnemonic device which helps buttress the rabbinic prohibition. It's not the source of the rabbinic prohibition. It's not, the pasuk doesn't mean that. The pasuk is merely saying that gives a certain hint. In this particular case, the pasuk doesn't say it's a man shayau, galiyah vatet, but the fact of the matter is that these are mnemonic devices which Chazal used to buttress the point as sort of to help us in this prohibition. But But it's clearly rabbinic in order. The question was only, what were the rabbis forbidden? Were the rabbis, wait a second, wait a second, let me just formulate it again. Were the rabbis forbidding specific things? Did the rabbi forbid hair, kol, seir, shofar? Did they forbid those specific things? Or were the rabbis not forbidding things? What were the rabbis forbidding? Sexual distraction with these as four examples. And there's a big difference in the two, where there's a social concept you can get used to sexual distraction, so it's no longer sexual distraction. I mean, that can be a very fundamental difference in our analysis of whether it's sneered as a relative concept or an absolute concept, because the bazaar come along saying A, B, C, or us, the rest are.
It's us,
and
the rest are.
What?
It defines the norm. It helps define
the norm. And helps define the norm.
Where's the Torah quote here?
The Torah, there is no Torah quote. This is all rabbinic in origin. The Torah's prohibition, as we learned last 2 weeks ago, is only genitalia. That's all. Genitalia are a halachic problem. That's
so
it.
Lo yireh
b'cha evad davar. And the Gemara talks about it in your camp, and the Gemara says when you, the way that we present your shulchan is when you're davening, you represent the machane shchinah. And the Torah talks about that when you're in the presence of God, there should be, and which is in the army camp. And you have the Aron Kodesh there, you cannot have any unseemly thing there. So when you establish the heavenly presence in you by davening, also that's true. And then you must say, but the Bible refers to that. That's how it works.
The question that the Asmachta, were they saying, these are sexually distracting things and I can prove it because it says in Shiur HaShirim this way? Or were they saying, I know this is sexually distracting and I can prove it? Or like, which was the basis?
I'm sure they're... by the fact that the Shir Shir mentions other things, and all sorts of, right? The Chazal were merely picking on those things which were much more problematic. I mean, what they felt were objectively problematic.
But why? It also bothered me about a woman's voice.
Why a woman's voice? Well, have you ever heard Carmen?
Yes.
Have you ever seen Carmen?
Yes.
That's halacha be problematic.
Have you seen Carmen?
Kata'aya mi maskir hayom. Okay. I think these are serious, and we'll get into this. The issue is, these are things that Chazal felt were problems of sexual distraction. I guess they didn't feel that hands, toes, teeth were problematic.
Was there a masoret of this?
No, this is truly an institution, and I don't know what generation this was instituted or recorded, but it's clearly that this is we're talking about
again,
in the Amorite period.
Very
this
little
kind of
are there any significant differences?
Are there any
significant differences with the Yerushalmi?
Mm-hmm.
They thought teachers.
No.
Other parts of the Amorite?
No. That's right, because one is, we talked about a person to himself, there's no problem with sexual distraction there. And there the problem talking about what is genitalia, at least what most women view as biblically prohibited. This is a question of sexually distracting. I can't have kavanah on God. I can't concentrate on my relationship with God. What? Well, we haven't read Rashi yet. We'll get into Rashi, but the Rishonim will explain it that way. That it's clear the question of Erevan. I mean, Erevan, there's Gentile, but it doesn't mean Gentile in any secular structure. It's clear from the example.
When you
write
a
Sultan,
they also use the phrase Erevan, and they say that's just...
The word Erevan there means it contravenes saying creation. That's how the Gemara understands it. We stole the creation. Okay? Let's by the way, I just want to throw out something that it's very problematic we'll deal with. It's a Seya Bishareva, right? To say she's married?
No.
Oh, yeah. All right, next, we'll come back to this. I just asked him the question. I'm not going to do any conclusion.
I've got another question. Yeah. In Genesis.
Yeah.
When God goes to
said, he did, Hashem say, why did you cover yourself? Why are you telling me? Who told you? Who told you to cover? You see, Hashem put man on earth naked and woman on earth naked. All of a sudden now we're faced with all these prohibitions of snius. Why? Is it man created or Hashem?
That's new here. This is a.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg here?
No, there's no problem. There's no problem to you until man became aware. What's the problem?
No, but you understand that Hashem put us on earth without any clothes on, and we were supposed to.
So right, so that was like, but
that
time marches on.
That's
true. Listen, one
second.
Okay, now we'll be rushing this stuff. Stop. Okay, maybe we'll go back. Hope to see you next week.
You're going to leave us all hanging.
The issues is the major issue. I agree that it's a problem. I agree the post-game are even afraid. I agree the post-game don't know where things are going. And when I talk to, they're clearly, we talk to several post-games, and it comes out from the article that there were post-games added to those, these women's prayer groups. One of the issues where they didn't know where it was going. They listened to a lot of the leadership, and the vocal leadership wanted to take it one way, while the rank and file of the women's prayer groups wanted to be an experience, a religious experience. And it depends. That a lot of the question of how do you ride the horse when you're not sure where it's going. Okay. I should point out that you have there was a statement made here, and I've seen it just too many times. On the issue of women's prayer groups, let me just talk about that, where I think I know the sugya called. There are many rabbani who permitted women to make birkot, when they took out the Sefer Torah, they made birkot of Torah, bona fide birkot of Torah, the way the men make them. And when we discussed very briefly, because I'm convinced it's against the Mishnah. There's no way you need a minyan for it. You need a bona fide minyan of 10 individuals obligated in the creed of Torah. Women are not obligated. And I've debated the other side on a variety of occasions. And when I come and I say, this is what the halacha says, this is what the Kesemit, this is what the Mishnah says, they give me this, quote, forgive me for being, pejorative, just give me this sob story of how these women need it, and they gotta pull out all the stops. I say, you don't go around being mocked of things, because you have this svara and this pshat against all the poskim. Now the article, and the question of women making brachot, they felt tremendous pathos, they wanted to come to the women, and they essentially looked for a das yachid to be matir. Okay, this is very, very problematic. It's not true that I would put it this way. This is, I think, is a classic example of ahava makalkelet et hashuha. The desire of these community rabbis to reach out to the women, they had tremendous compassion for their frustration, put them into the position where they were matter something that they're in a normal circumstance, they never would have been matter. Okay, and I'm not talking about a situation where it's, it's 60-40. And when you have a 60-40 split, that's half and half. And it's a question of what do you believe is the truth. This is a case where the person was not looking for the truth. He was here to answer a need. Okay? And that's not the argument in the letter that no matter what pressure, you're not going to change usur to mutter. That's not true. It's not true. I've seen it happen. Okay? And the rabbi, I don't know how the rabbi rationalizes it. He rationalizes it the way he feels fit. But the fact of the matter is, this is a situation where I stood up there debating on several occasions with these individuals, how do you matter such a thing? I gave them all the makoros. I said, you're right, but. It doesn't work that way. And unfortunately, it's problematic. If you're dealing with a situation, and this happened many times, Rav Moshe Feinstein goes into a sugya. Let's give you an example. The sugya was artificial insemination. And the question is, do you need an artificial insemination who's not the husband? Who do you take as the donor? Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion you can take a non-Jew as the donor. Because there is no lineage to a non-Jew's semen, and there's no suffragal lineage to a non-Jew, and therefore, there's no circulations because it's semen, and it's done by the doctor through a needle, there's no prohibitions, and et cetera, et cetera. And Rav Moshe was the opinion that in this situation, you can have artificial insemination from a non-Jew to a married woman, and the child's fine, kosher, no problem. The majority of the poskim disagree with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Sattler harassed Rav Moshe, called him up at 1 o'clock in the morning. They literally came down his throat. They thought they were a matari surim, how do you do such a thing? And they literally harassed him. To the point that Rav Moshe at some point had introduced, he would ask, he often answer the phone himself, and he had a rabbi, so he answered the phone for him. It was a very, very tough situation. Rav Moshe refused to attract this position, even though he knew, because he felt it was Emes. And he's a first-rate posek, okay? But you're dealing with an average community rabbi, there's a tremendous amount of pressure that's put on it, and very often they were willing to make positions, decisions that should be left perhaps for a more serious post-com. And on this particular question, public policy issues should not always, the person to make it is not always the local rabbi. Well, for the kids. Because he doesn't always have the sweep of halacha, and he doesn't always have the sense. There's a sense of where halacha is going in some sweep. Anybody who believes that people like Rosh Hashanah Zalman Auerbach or Moshe Feinstein weren't in touch with the generation doesn't know what a post is really like. And this brings me to the second letter, which I'd like to also read. No, you don't have it.
Excuse me, I would have just you said something before. That women may be permitted to say bracha for the Sefer Torah.
I said, didn't
behind,
say that. I didn't
behind
say
the mechitza.
I didn't say that. No, I didn't say that. I said to make the bracha, you need a minyan. To make Birkat the Torah for getting an aliyah, you need a bona fide minyan. That's a separate issue. We'll, some point we'll discuss about the whole question of women aliyahs. We'll get to it. Okay? And we'll discuss it at great length. But you need a bona fide minyan. Let me just read the second letter. I believe that it is important to agitate for maximal participation by women in organized Jewish life, so long as there are women for whom this is important. The knee-jerk assumption of wrong motivation by post-student gets annoying. On a personal level, I fear the obligations that come alongside the privileges. I don't want to have to run them again 3 times a day, at least to feel you're obligated. And I'm heedful of the adage, be careful what you ask, you might just get it. On a semi-related topic, there seemed to be a strong disagreement between you and the ladies, quote unquote, about what halacha would look like, whether it would look different if women had always participated in the halakhic process. I think most of us find it hard to believe that it would look the same. In thinking about why this could be, I realized that rabbis we have or have contact with are standard shul rabbis. And there are a couple of not nice things about shul rabbis, which I won't go into. Few, if any of us, and this is the important point, few if any of us have ever talked to someone who could be called a real person. And maybe because of that, we have less respect than we should for the process. What do you think? I think that's tremendous truth. I must tell you that I've had several experiences to talk to real post-game. And I mean, the guys at the top. Be it Rav Moshe Feinstein or now some Duncan Feinstein, or some of Leipzig. You get such a breath. Anybody has ever heard a sheer from a Soloveitchik, has heard a shear from a mind. It's a whole different feeling. It's a feeling like you're there at Sinai. It's a very different feeling. It's a whole different perspective. And you have to understand that a person is considered a posek not because he was elected posek. No. In Jewish community, when the Rambam talks about who's a Navi, it's very interesting. The Rambam talks about who's a, how do you know he's a good Navi? So Rambam says, ask the people. There's something about Vox populi, vox dei. I mean, the voice, the people know. You want to know who's the boss? They ask the people, not the universe. They'll give you now the truth of the matter is. And I honestly believe, and I discussed this with several people, that the face of halacha is essentially molded in every generation by about 10 people. I don't say there are hundreds of tshuvas and hundreds of responses, but there's this group that sort of rises to the top. And when you want to know, you know, who molds psak, and for the long term, it's these posters. Lahavdil, Elif Alfei Abdalot. You know, there's a lot of music out there, but there's only a certain amount of music that's classic. That's a classic piece that lasts a long time. The fact that I happen to love A Lion Sleeps Tonight, Wimbleway, is irrelevant to the question whether it competes. There's certain things that are classics, and everybody knows they're classics. You may enjoy it, maybe a wonderful shiur, maybe interesting post, they can be explained. There's certain amount, you know, when they said Vox Populi Vox Dei, I don't mean to say that it's a halacha, but there is a mechanism where there's a consensus develops about who are the post, and it cuts across lines. I remember walking when the Shlomo Zalman Orbach passed away. I went to the funeral, and there was just like, we went to the funeral, and I started walking there, and you had to see the throngs of people, you know, people, Sugot, and Bekishes, and Kapatas, and this type of Svartim, and Ashkenazim, and this Kilon, they were walking down Karen Kayemet Street, because we were walking towards the area where he lived, and the Chilonim are just watching these throngs of people. And he said, "What's going on?" I said, "Shlomo Zalman Orbach passed away." He said, "Who?" I mean, they knew all the political figures. They never heard of Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Never heard of him. There's a certain thing about a first-class posting that is very unique and very special. And and these are the people that mold halacha. So if you would ask me whether, and let me just add one more comment and then come back to the fundamental point. A lot of the greatest resistance to change in halakha, especially on the woman's issue, not come from the rabbis, came from the woman herself. And I remember that, and I've been consulted on very several issues with regard to women's prayer groups. The ones who fought tooth and nail, women dancing with the same Torah were other.
Against it.
They felt.
That's a sociological phenomenon that's known about within women communities. I mean, I don't know if that particularly pertains only to Orthodox or
Orthodox. I didn't say it is. The point I'm trying to make is, I don't think that the opinions held, quote unquote, by misogynist men, male chauvinist men, are very much different than some of the opinions held by women of the same community. I don't think that the essence of being a man or a woman and your commitment to halacha, that to some extent molds your view of halacha. I will agree that on public policy issues, there may be a sensitivity or awareness about your form of community, you know, that is, as a woman, you might see the issue of where on this motivation issue, I could see that might play a role. But I know for a fact that many poskim on a whole variety of issues, and I mean it very seriously, consult the wives. Now, I don't know if the wives on these issues are any wiser. I don't know if they know, but I know for a fact that poskim don't generally go into these public policy decisions without consulting people who they consider no better. They're interested in truth, they're not interested in making, you know, I'm willing to say that I think that there are a lot of public policy issues in which the posting are afraid to change, and they tend to say, so we don't want you to do it. But if you look at Bible posting, look at Rav Salavech, you look at Rav Chanan, Rav Yeshua, you look at Rav Aaron, you look at Dalia Schwartz, who's now the posting woman, because he's the head Dayan of the RCA, Betty. If you talk to these people, these are very, even the Marshall Schechter, okay, who came out against women's programs, these are people who are really nice guys. who are sensitive to modernity, who understand what it means to be a woman in the modern world, you know, have door wives and daughters and grandchildren, and we're all going to university, understand the crisis of that. And I think that you have to be sensitive that they are entrusted with making decisions, whether right or wrong. Now, I'm still not convinced that on the flow of halacha, that there would have been a change.
I don't think you addressed that. Because of exactly the point that we started to say, there are no women posting, and women haven't sat on the shiurim with these gedolim. And I think that makes a very big difference historically. I don't know if there had been gedolot hador, that they might have had different interpretations or different gishot. They didn't happen. We're only now talking about that. Only now you're really educated women or university educated. I don't say they're gedolot hador, but it hasn't happened. And, you know, I've never sat in Reb Aaron's shiur, and I was in Shkoki since the day the man came. He never opened a shiur for women.
Not in yeshiva, but there were public shiur. Rav Yosher Ber, look, I know that Rav Yosher Ber, son of the Etchik Shir, was open to women in the
world. I was in California. No, what I'm saying is that there really has been a very big discrepancy, and I think that that's where, this is sort of a moot point, but philosophically, I think that it still holds up, that we had a flow of really educated, intense women who were involved in halachic and
you know,
issues, perhaps there would be a different
gisha.
I think only today we're beginning to see a little
bit. Okay, so this is the issue that we disagreed about, and last week as well. And I feel that it's a matter, to some extent, if you're dealing with interpretation of halacha, I believe it's a matter of faith. And that's what I argue for. Mm-hmm. I believe that to argue that halacha, I'm not talking about public policy decisions. That I might be willing to concede. Because that's how a rabbi sees the community at first. Particular public policy decisions are things that changed. And we saw, when he talked about Kaddish, we saw the change occurring. And and I'm telling you, in another 50 years, it'll be a non-issue. Women saying Kaddish will be a non-issue in 50 years. Okay, people will say, where were they ever asked? And that happened the last, I'd say, from the war years on. Before that, it was general policy. Women generally did not say Kaddish, although we saw several exceptions. There was a clear case where something was ossered because of public policy decisions. I felt the women were unhired, and that there was bad reasons for them to do it. Okay? They felt in confusion, and there were men saying Kaddish from the Amidah part, the Betzibur, the Amidah, the Shiach, the Betzibur, and Kaddish, which might be confused. Right? And the post now realized that there are other public policy conditions in the modern period which are more important that outweigh that public policy, that consideration, and things are changing. Things are definitely changing, and I tell you, 50 years, I don't think it will be a non-issue. However, and again, so on public policy decisions, yes, I wanted to say that maybe if the women were there with their hand on the pulse, maybe a slightly different pulse, decisions might be maybe made different in public policy. As far as the flow of halacha is concerned, interpretation of the chumash, as far as other than the fact that there would have been more minds, instead of having 100 tannaim, we might have had 200 tannaim, okay? And I don't feel the flow of halacha would change. Okay, that's my feeling. And as I point out, to be suspect that they made those decisions because they were men. And my position is they were in search of truth. And the decisions were not made as men, but as scholars. Okay, to argue that because they were men, they interpreted it this way, essentially opens up the interpretation of halacha to anything. Because they lived in Babylonia, they said that, and therefore, because that means that the Torah is not really reflective of only Babylonian perspective.
That is the point, because the fact is that a lot of the rules of the Golden Standard of Year are based on where and when the person lives. So that's all kids' issue.
Excuse me, that's clearly a takana, and we know that it was done. They say it was done.
But each person, you know, the prostate is not living in a vacuum. And if the prostate is a man, which in all the cases it has been a man, you can't divorce the human being and his outlook on life, whatever it might be, and wherever and whenever.
Let me reduce to an absurdum. Your argument is, and what I mentioned last week, that one could argue the reason why, let's assume that the Canaanites were black, okay? So that the reason why Rav Moshe said to destroy everybody because Moshe hated blacks. He was white, after all. And he hated blacks. Now, you can make, I can make arguments from here on the Hodaba that every decision in the Torah was based on some, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu felt that way. That's why he said that.
No, I think you would have avoided this argument. Because if there had been women there, that if women had been equal in discussing these things, and everybody was seeking truth, and the truth that they came to is the truth that we have today, then you wouldn't have this argument.
I don't know. I just had discussions with whether it's endless or not endless. The Torah's true, you know.
Well, but the more women that you can educate,
I'm in favor of that. I'm not against that. You get the wrong guy. But I'm trying to say that what we got as a Masorah from what, you know, what came down from, that when Moshe came, women from Sinai, we maintain that it is as accurate as it possibly humanly
can.
No,
you know, something that happened based on the location, you know, Southern Europe, Northern Europe, winter time. I mean, the certain that unfortunately, my brain does not retain things that I have. Of course, and it's the way that a number of years ago, I had a drop in the middle, but the whole premise of the course was actually taking the halach issue and following the rulings of the Tolkien from the times of the Mishnah through modern times. The same issue, different approaches. I just don't remember any of the issues, any examples. I can't bring them here, but the point is the same, that there weren't differences based on where and when.
Because the challenges were different.
Obviously.
And there's something different. The responses were different. There's no question that Allah responds to specific locales, but to say that the principle, we're arguing, we're not talking about how the Pesach, look at the Pesach, there's no question if you're dealing with Catholicism versus dealing with Muslim, with Mohammedanism, the Pesach are going to be radically different. However, but to say that the principle is going to be different, the principles we're dealing with, that's what you're saying. You're saying that because the transmitters of halacha were male, therefore the principles would have been different.
No, because there are a number of ways of interpreting certain points, okay, the interpretation is done by a human being and not by a computer. And so
I think doing your argument against was to take something to its extreme,
correct,
reach an absurdity, and then say that the whole argument was absurd. So that's not fair.
But that's how you test principles. But that's how you test principles. You test principles.
You can take it to the other extreme, which is to say that women and men think exactly the like, and there would be no differences in nuance. And I think that's also false.
I disagree. You think that male mathematics is different than female mathematics? Do you think male chemistry is different than female chemistry? Male law is different than female law?
Yes, male law is definitely different from female.
Male psychologists are from female psychologists.
Absolutely. I would argue that since our position is, maintain as a position of faith, that since the Tanoim and the Morim were interested in truth, that was the highest, that was their greatest goal. And it would not have bothered them one iota to make women witnesses if they felt that the Torah permitted it. The same halacha that gave women, contrary to the whole world around them, equal rights and monetary rights and equal rights in business against the whole world around them, would have a problem. That a woman comes to court, right? A woman comes to court, she can sue her husband. You ever hear such a thing in the Babylonian world at the time? So why should a woman, why all of a sudden they said the woman can't be witnesses? That same doesn't make sense. It just doesn't go the line. It doesn't go the line. It's because they thought that was the MS. They thought that was true. It's a position of faith. I can't argue with you. I can just say the position of faith, and to challenge that position very readily, forgive me for reducto ad absurdum, but very readily leads into a conservative position, which anybody's invited to take, a conservative position in which all Torah is relative and determined, and therefore each rabbi in each generation has the right to say, well, now we have different factors, it's not as important. That's where it leads. Okay? And I'm not giving a value judgment to it. I'm just saying that that's part of our acceptance of what we call Emunat Chachamim. And I talk about Emunat Chachamim in the modern sense of Das Torah. Emunat Chachamim, that the Masura that we've had from the Tanoim and the Amoraim, the Anshikas, all the way down through generations, was one where the ultimate goal was what is the Ratzon HaBoreh. No other side issues. And when side issues got in, they came out of the wash.
There's something that bothers me here. If you assume that women were, and correct me if I'm wrong, forbidden to learn Talmud the way men learn Talmud, right, then doesn't it follow that all the decisions and all the poskim and all the response and the defenses around the law would be male-oriented?
No, male-determined.
Or male, if it's male-determined, then wouldn't it then follow that women would want to have something that was more female determined to allow for their place in the world? If women were allowed to learn Talmud from the beginning, yeah, I think it would be very different. Okay, I think it would be very different.
Well, I think we're trying the same way.
No, but
the problem is,
I think when you
say
the
extreme,
you have to differentiate between what's the significance in the Torah and what's took that as said. Other reasons, like to give offense around the Torah. If you're going to take an orthodox view of it, then you're going to say that what's written in the written Torah is by God, and you can't argue with it. But there's other things that, you know, when you say that later on, in later times, when they're very similar, this is still made about, say, putting fences around the Torah. But this is more open to approach in the external world. That's a big deal.
Let me just say a couple other points I want to make. And then we really should try to move on a little bit. And this is very fascinating, and I admit, we've been saying the same thing over and over again. Let me just make one more point. One of the things that does bother me, is the resistance of rabbis and balabatim. How do women do things that are halacha said? In Shulchan Aruch, it's mutter. I mean, the hassle that women will give, that a group of three women sit together, rather than a group of women, three women sit together, and want to make a decision. Do you know the hackles that are raised of the issues whether three women should make a decision or not?
Alone?
Can we talk? Since you raised the issue, let me just point out, and thank you for raising it, because you set me up. The postings, what are the issues that are men there? So all the poskim say, but what's the problem? In fact, I mentioned Rosh Hashanah and Arba, and many other poskim, when we discussed this, say prefers the men to answer. And if there are two men there, they answer. There's no problem. You're worried about the sin, but also they won't say. We'll talk about sin in a moment, if you ever get there. So the men say won't say, but what the men is doing? The three women make the zimun, and the men answer. Why should that be a problem? I mean, or the issue of the insensitivity, okay, very often, that they're getting up to daven mincha, and there are a couple of women who want to get up to daven mincha, and there's no arrangements made for the women to daven mincha. Okay, marid, it's very rare that women daven. Extremely, because the Mishapur already said, even though that the Aruch HaShulchan says women should daven, it's extremely rare that women daven marid, and it's very yipitei skula that the women daven marid. I mean, there's a great deal of hesitancy to have women to do that which they're obligated to do, or a variety of things. And that bothers me. Do you know that? If a woman wants to get up and not in the shul, but in general, in the job community, women want to say they're going to go in. But most in the Mishnah Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Kaf HaChai, what happened to Wednesday? Women are hard to say they're going to go in. Why don't they say they're going to go in? I give all sorts of reasons. She's in shame. So there are all sorts of ways of doing it, including, according to many posts, you say amongst there's 10 women making meeting when we're going to go in. So, but the women don't do it. I mean, and they're not encouraged to do it, and when they do it, they're feminists.
Not necessarily. I mean, there are places in this town. I mean, I benched Gomel at another shul in this town when my daughter was born. And what happened was, I got to shul, I brought the baby, and Shabbos, what happened to Shabbos after she was born. And there was this gap, I mean, j-
Josh went out and there's this gang, they were waiting for you to come in, they were so happy to see you, into my bracha. But
because they thought they were doing something radical, too.
It was an embarrassment issue on the women's part. They don't know if they're doing the right thing or they can't. I think the encouragement...
But I'm saying they should be encouraged by the rabbi. They should encourage them to do these things.
I think encouragement is really important, and that's maybe what's missing. The encouragement is missing.
A girl wants to get, has a bat mitzvah and wants to give it to her Torah to the Kiddush, okay? I wouldn't chas v'shalom say that she should do like my daughter to give it to her Torah, sure. I would say that, but to give it to her Torah in shul, in the Kiddush, the girl should get up and give advice, and we should encourage her. So last time I mentioned it, the father says, but you don't have any of the boys in the shul doing it. And then there were times the boys did do it in the shul. I don't know what happened. But there were times the boys, people should be encouraged. The women should be encouraged to do those things. Which Allah says perfectly much of it. Moshe says the farish, that a woman, that the girl can give advice or the kiddush and stuff like that. And there's a thing. Okay. And that bothers me a great deal too. So. And I agree. I also agree that there's a great deal of fear. The post people don't know what things are going. They feel that the earth is shaking. I had a talk with several really modern, really B'nai Torah, really B'nai Torah with their heads screwed on right, people who really, that they're really very scared because some of the women that they talk to are very angry. It's not just a question of agitating or wanting more, or trying to say, let's sit down, let's try to be creative, let's try to see what we can do here. Question of the rabbi had a shul, because he doesn't want to do what they want to do. He felt, he said, this is not good, the shul's going to fall to pieces. And these women said, I don't care. They don't care if the shul can make splinters. You know, you have a rabbi who has, on the hand, has a whole bunch of old timers, right, who don't want the role of the world to change one iota. And they're 50% of the shul, and then they have another group of people. What else are rabbis supposed to do in such a situation? Right? So the best thing you can do is try to educate, try to mold, but it can't be, you know, freedom now. It doesn't work that way. And it's very often rabbis are called them a tremendous, terrible job of life.
Oh yeah, is this just an American phenomenon, or is this also among the Israelis? Because I have the feeling that it's mostly among Americans who have been brought up.
Not just Americans, Europeans.
I would say that it's
negative.
I keep getting fed from the English. I know what's going on in England. I would say that it's clearly in it's not that Israeli. There's all the issues on women by the Kotel and all sorts of experimental, but they connect it to all of our issues. I would say that you'll find more and more create Megillah readings for women, which, as I pointed out, a major post people come out in favor of it. They're always led by others of my Nana, and Zosha Koren started it. I know Rehoboth, who started it, I know what's going on. I mean, but they're always an American theorist. There are Israeli women get involved, and in Ranana, there are 300 women that create Megillah readings. Okay, and there are a lot of Israeli women. When I was asked to speak there, I spoke in, the place was filled with Israel. I spoke in Hebrew, Israelis and Americans.
But the schools here also, the Orthodox, don't teach Gemara to the girls. I know my granddaughter in Ramot does have, because that's a school connected with Rabbi Riskin. But I know Sfira doesn't teach the girls.
Well, in the fourth grade, the boys started learning Gemara in Tachkam. Well, there was a school.
The girls get to go home early.
In the third grade, in Tachkamoni, they had a Chug Gemara for the boys. Chug Gemara for the boys, and my daughter Michal showed up. So the Yoetzer came to her and said, doesn't it bother you that you're the only girl in this Chug Gemara? She said, no. she stuck it out for the rest of the year. I mean, the fact, of course, she doesn't come out with Rava, but the fact of the matter is, I would say that the establishment has much more problem with it than the kids do. So, can we go do some? Yeah, that's what we're here for. Okay, we're going to start. Let me just quickly review what we did 2 weeks ago. We saw, we're talking about Tzniut.
Yes.
Well, we're going to get to this, hopefully, sometime. Let me just quickly review what we did to it. So we learned that there are three types of Tzniut. There's Tzniut before God, By the way, anybody, seriously, anybody who wants to further thoughts on this subject, would like to let me have it, you're more than welcome to write. I don't always promise to answer, but I will read it, take it to heart, maybe cry. Now, so the three types of tzniut. First, it's tzniut before God, and this is clearly, as we saw, the feeling that how much nudity one can show, and the privacy has nothing to do with people being around, prayer, not just fact in the privacy realm, how much nudity, how much you can bear yourself. And this is clearly society and locationally dependent. You know, people walk around in communities where nobody walks around in shorts. It's princess for men to walk around in shorts. You don't walk around that. It's revealing too much flesh. However, in communities where they do walk around that way, and it's perfectly considered legit, it's not considered any lack of modesty. The second type of tzniut that we talked about has to do with tzniut in prayer. It has to be a nudity. If I'm in the bathhouse and I want to, the people walk around who are naked and I want to drink, it's not standing in front of God in prayer. I want to make a bracha, okay? They have to understand, the halacha makes a different distinction between, on one hand, tfilah shmona esrei versus even kriyat shema and bracha. That's the other category. Because kriyat shema, for instance, is a declaration of faith. I'm not supposed to picture myself. When I say shmona esrei, I'm supposed to picture myself in front of the King of Kings making my request. That's how I'm supposed to pick myself. I'm supposed to be dressed nicely or neatly. I'm supposed to be dressed the way I should not be dressed in a fashion that looks like a schmuck. Right? If I saw the president or the prime minister or somebody important, I wanted to make a request for me, and I make sure I look decent and my clothing wasn't stained. I mean, you have to be dressed properly in order to, the question is, do I have to wear a tie, you know, suit and jacket? That's clearly the ideal. Or do I have to wear, for a woman, do I have to wear a suit and be nicely dressed? Or can I be sufficient a way that if I would meet an important person in the street, I wouldn't be embarrassed? Right? If I met Clinton while he's jogging around. The halacha seems to require you, ideally, to be dressed to the hilt. Minimally, to be dressed in a fashion that you would not be embarrassed if you met an important person on the street, and you looked decently. You looked decent, not necessarily your best clothing, but nice clothing. That's how you should be dressed when you're done. When it comes to brachot, or even kriyat shema, the halacha doesn't require that. The halacha says that you can be dressed minimally. It's very interesting. Dressed minimally. It's a different perception of what you're doing when you do these different things. And the halacha there says that clearly nudity is out. And we talked about a woman making a bracha in the mikveh. We saw that since she's the water is essentially covers her. And we talked about various considerations. The second issue when it comes to prayer happens to be with sexual distraction. So here you're supposed to be concentrating on God, and you don't want anything sexual distraction. And we're going to get into that. And in that sexual distraction I talk about, the halacha generally talks about men being sexually distracted by women, but the halacha, we'll also briefly, we'll see why we can briefly, talk about being women being sexually distracted by men. And then the generally talk about before men, that has to do with sexual distraction. That's a general problem, sexual distraction. We'll have to say something's wrong with being sexually distracted. Why is that a problem? Okay, we'll talk about it. Is it clear to everybody? Why is us? Why is it us that we're sexually distracted? What's the problem? Okay, now, we also learned that there were, okay, that's, now what we're going to start doing is we're going to start reading just the background material. The source of the background material, let's start on page 5. What we're going to do is we're going to learn that. No. Forget my okay, page 5, which is the Zirat of Steinsatz from Brachot of Chavdal Ramadan. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to learn the Gemara, and as we go through the Gemara, we're going to ask a lot of questions. Not necessarily answer all of them. We'll answer them as we go through the Halacha, through the Shulchan Aruch. But let's now just learn the basic material, and you can ask questions as you go on, okay? The Gemara starts at Dalet. This whole Gemara deals, by the way, with a husband, for instance, saying Kriyat Shema Alamita when you're in bed with your husband and wife. Remember, they start in the nude. So how do you? The halacha deals with that. The halacha deals what? I'm a Rabbi Yitzhak. Okay, now we're going to Tefach B'Isha Erva. Dara, you guys with me? I'm a Rabbi Yitzhak. Tefach B'Isha Erva. Okay, a revealed fistful of a woman's flesh is considered Erva. It's considered Erva means, Erva means nudity, okay? What the halacha is attempting to say is, just as one is forbidden to pray, in front of exposed genitals, even their own exposed genitals, so too, it is forbidden it's forbidden for one to pray in the presence of an exposed area of the size of a fist, of a woman's body. Okay? Now, the Gemara asks, okay, so Tefach B'Isha Erva. The Gemara says, Lamai, for what reason? For what is this halakha? I've already said, sort of hit to the punchline, but the Gemara says, Lamai, for what purpose is this the problem? Ile malasta kuleba, if you mean it is forbidden to stare at her. Now, in halakha, there are three categories. One is looking, staring, and leering. Okay? Looking is looking. The other one is istaklut, means you're looking for the purpose of deriving pleasure. Hey, she's a pretty woman. You're looking. The other one, leering, is with a sexual connotation. Usually it's called istaklut l'shem znut. Okay? What is l'hanot? Because it's with you, but you have no. She's a beautiful woman. You're enjoying looking at a beautiful woman. Okay, that's staring, and leering is to drive this clear sexual pleasure. Okay, so looking, staring, leering. So it says ile malistakuleba. If you mean it's for the purpose of staring at her to derive pleasure, then that's actually sexual pleasure, but staring at her. Vahara amar Rav Sheshet, lama manach katuv tachshitim shebachutz. In Tachshitim Shabifnim, when the Torah recounts the spoils of Midian, the Bnot Moav, it mentions golden ornaments that were handed over by the people. One are rings and earrings like that. The other one were chastity belts. So the Gemara says, why do you list all these things together in the same breath? Chastity belts, which are considered more private golden ornaments, with the external ornaments, which are earrings and rings and the like. Intakshitim shebefnim lo malacha kol ha-mistakel be'etzvah ktana shel isha ki'ilu mistakel b'makom ha-torah. If you even stare at a woman for the purpose of deriving pleasure, and you're staring at her, even if it's only in her pinky, it is just as forbidden as staring at her when she's totally naked. B'makom ha-torah means staring at her genitals. Ella. Gemara says, no, what is it talking about? Ela b'ishto ula kriyat shema. To tell me that it's forbidden, if your wife is walking down where a part of her body is exposed, which is normally covered, okay? Even if she's your wife, it's forbidden, and it's forbidden for kriyat shema. It means for davening, it's certainly awesome. But even for kriyat shema, it's a problem. Now, there's a question, in many some ways, you have to understand davening is more stringent, and many sometimes it's less stringent than the Kriyat Shema. And there's a balance. Because on the one hand, if I say Kriyat Shema, you're still standing in front of God. Kriyat Shema is merely a statement of faith. But on the other hand, Kriyat Shema is a biblical obligation. And I'm saying saying here you can't fulfill, that if there's a woman around who's wanting to, I can't field Sri Krishna. I can't say Krishna. It contravenes my fulfillment of my biblical obligation.
If a woman is around, or if a woman is around with exposed.
Exposed.
In other words, if I'm standing like this, I mean, and I'm no problem, right? Then what's the point of the mechitza?
Well, I would suppose the man depends on the woman, but I would say we'll talk about the mechitza in a moment. What's the function? Not in a moment, right? But that's the next topic. The next topic is. We're going to learn to see it first, and then we're going to talk about mechitza. And the question we're going to ask is, what's the function of the mechitza? Is the function of mechitza to prevent these type of problems? Or is it how we have totally different function? We'll see that. The fundamental machloket. Yes. But let me say, so the Gemara Halacha says here, tefach bisha means an exposed. Now, tefach means, essentially, it's about 3.5 inches by, and that tefach is approximately somewhere between 3.2 inches of Reb Chaim Noah to 3.8 inches, depends on how you measure this distance. Let's take it as 3.5 inches, approximately. 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches. Okay, that's the area that has to be exposed, and it's a square area, which means it can be, you know, a half a tefach by 2 tefachim. And it gets, we'll talk about